You're listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast.
Welcome back to the Faith Unpacked podcast with Jamie and Jason. This is episode 265, and today we're going to look at Jesus's very famous Sermon on the Mount. And I don't know exactly how we're going to do this and how we're going to break it down and what passage or how far we're going to go with each episode. But Jamie, my thought is, you know, there's so much rich discipleship content in the Sermon on the Mount. And it's just it's a passage, honestly, that I think for as much as its popularity, it's amazing how many different interpretations there are. Some people have argued things like, is it still applicable or is it yet applicable to Christians? Some will say it's the kingdom ethic. And by that, they're saying it belongs in the millennial kingdom. And so essentially it's like, okay, that passage is on hold. We don't have to regard that passage for now. And others will say, well, it's not so much that it's on hold, but it's an ideal that Jesus was sort of holding out to Israel and saying, if you will accept my message of the kingdom, then I will accept you. And it's almost like a law. Some people have seen it as just strictly law. And you get all kinds of interpretations. Jamie, I was reading about how when it gets down to it, some people have taken some of the words of Jesus so literally, and maybe you should say like literalistically, because some people don't understand what I mean by literally, but not metaphorically, not with any nuance. Instead, like when Jesus says to cut off your right hand if it causes you to sin, like literally, we have records from church history of guys like Origen who castrated himself because he thought that's what he needed to do because of his struggle with sexual temptation. And, you know, you look at it and it's like, did Jesus really want a whole bunch of maimed and marred, physically maimed and marred people? And was he saying this is the entrance requirement to be the kingdom? I don't take it that way. And I think that that's why we want to look at the Sermon on the Mount, because number one, it's super impactful. If you just sit down, and I'd encourage all of our listeners to read through it, give it a read, and you know, you're not going to fully grasp it on one reading, obviously, if it's so rich that you need to just kind of get into it again and again. But look for the nuance in Jesus's words. That doesn't mean make of it what you want. It doesn't mean find your own personalized meaning that's only for you. But it does mean that the application that Jesus gives in the Sermon on the Mount is not strictly literal. There is certainly stuff that it's like very clear what Jesus is saying, and we just have to straight up obey him. But let me take another example. Like when he says, and we'll get to this in another episode maybe, but when he says, if someone requires you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Now, if I was to be strictly literal, I would say, okay, so this means that if someone requires me to go with him 1 mile, and that's all he wants, it doesn't matter if that's all he wants. I'm going to say, hey, you know what? Jesus said to go 2 miles, so I don't care if you only wanted to go one. We're going 2 miles. You know, obviously, no. There's nuance in there, and there's the heart of what Jesus is saying. That is what we really want to grasp, not just the wooden, literalistic interpretation. And I think just one more thing on introduction is it does apply for today, but we don't want to make it into a law that says if you are not living by this standard, then you must not be a Christian. What I think Jesus is doing, and we'll talk about this, Jamie. By the way, we haven't talked about like what our interpretations are, so we might disagree on this some. But here's what I'll say. My interpretation of it is if we are seeing this as the kingdom ethic, like this, he keeps talking about the kingdom in this sermon. He's saying this is what God's heart is like. And this is what the heart of a disciple of Jesus is like, someone who wants to be like Father in heaven. This is what you should aspire to be like. This is who the Holy Spirit will make you into over time. And I think when we understand it more in that frame of mind, that this is what it looks like to be practicing what it looks like to follow Jesus, it starts to make more sense. And there's a lot more grace in that than the law version that says, you're either doing this or you ain't in, right? That's another way people throughout church history have been interpreting it at times. And maybe we'll get into that as we go. But anything, introductory remarks you want to make, Jamie, as we start looking at the sermon?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good, introduction, and certainly covers a lot of the different aspects of that. One side of it takes and says, this is really Jesus saying we have a works-based righteousness. To a degree, you could argue like liberal theology has that perspective, right? That we just follow these three chapters of Jesus' teaching and we're good, you know, good religious people. And certainly there's a little bit of truth to that in the sense that, you know, if we honor these three chapters of Jesus' teaching, then we are going to be better people, because it's all about, you know, loving the Lord and loving your neighbor and doing what is right and just and godly. But there's no indication at all, and certainly we would argue it's counter gospel to argue that your salvation is wrapped up in, you know, human effort or human works. I like the way you pointed it out on the other side, that there's also those who say, well, then these are commands that we just do that, right? That basic thing, and we've fulfilled it. And in reality, no, it's actually bigger, broader, more difficult. And I would argue, and you would argue as well, that we cannot do it apart from the work of the Lord in us, right? There's so much of this that it's like, nah, I don't want to do that. My flesh doesn't want to do that. My desires, I don't want to do that. My sin nature and selfishness, I don't want to do that. And to a degree, I would argue I cannot do that apart from the Lord and his work in me. I thought you framed that really, really well, just as a starting place. And then, of course, obviously, we don't want to make the mistake that many have made, where they also say the Sermon on the Mount has no context, and so we can just take it and use it however we will. You know, as if every line, yes, he starts out with the Beatitudes in Matthew chapter 5, which are more like one line statements. But then he develops into greater teaching, which is more textually connected. And so part of how do we understand some of these statements is in relationship to what their greater context was. You know, we understand, like you brought up the example of cutting your arm off or gouging out your eye. Well, what does that even mean? What's that even about? And we look at the context of, topically that Jesus is talking about to help us understand what he's actually driving at there. And so all of those things, what we call basic biblical hermeneutics, come into play even in Jesus' words here, and we don't, like we've so often heard, take those out of context, take them out of the greater truths of the rest of Jesus' teaching in the Gospels, or even the teaching of the rest of the Bible, if we do, we're going to end up obviously in some really bad places, and certainly outside of the context of what Jesus was trying to communicate.
Yeah, it's a great point, Jamie. And I think, you know, as far as context goes, in the larger Gospel of Matthew, and we recognize, you know, so if anybody's kind of newer to the Bible, there's four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And originally the manuscripts were headed with not the Gospel of Matthew, but the Gospel according to Matthew, the Gospel according to Mark. Because really there's one Gospel, and what we have with the four Gospel books is four different men recording eyewitness testimony of their, or a close associate of theirs, interactions with Jesus. And so really what we have is Matthew recording what he saw. He was there, and he experienced this sermon firsthand. He was with Jesus. And one of his themes that he wants to especially highlight in his gospel is that Jesus is king, and the kingdom, when people sometimes talk about the kingdom, but then they don't want the king, right? You know, it's very popular to talk about the kingdom today. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes people leave out any mention of, well, how do I get in the kingdom? And it's always through the king. Jesus is the kingdom bringer. He is the way into the kingdom. And I think that's just so significant, because you look at, what does Matthew do at the beginning of his gospel? He first lays out his genealogy that establishes the royal line. Why is Jesus qualified to be Israel's Messiah, Israel's king? And then you look at the fact that King Herod wants to kill him. You look at his first message is the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And then when you get into all of his parables, which come after the Sermon on the Mount, it's all about the kingdom, right? And then you close out the Gospel of Matthew after Jesus has died, risen again, and he's getting ready to ascend, and he says, all authority has been given in heaven and on earth has been given to me. And that's the authority of the king. Jesus is speaking as a king. And that's so important, because honestly, the Sermon on the Mount, it would not carry the power that it does over the ages if it wasn't spoken by a king. And even the people who first listened to Jesus recognized that. Matthew 7:28, the very close of the sermon, says, and when Jesus finished these sayings, the crowds were astonished at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one who had authority and not as their scribes. So once again, he was, even by the way he taught, he was separating himself from all other teachers. He wasn't just another expositor, he was the authoritative source of godliness, and he was the authority. He was the king speaking. And anyway, I think that's important because of, when we talk about the kingdom, we don't want to just talk about it as some abstract ideal without recognizing you need to know the king to be a part of this kingdom. Yeah, so we can start with the Beatitudes, because that's where the sermon begins. I think the Beatitudes are definitely one of those passages that people have wrestled with and struggled to understand exactly what it all means. But if I was to give kind of a 30,000-foot view, I would say it's a message about what true blessedness in the kingdom looks like. And let me just read the opening ones here. Jesus opened his mouth and taught them, saying, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And you look at those, Jamie, and they are not like desirable qualities in our world. When you think about poverty of spirit, like, who wants to be poor? Who wants to be known as being like, I'm the poor one, right? Or those who mourn. Well, I don't like to mourn. I like to be happy. I like to celebrate. I like to be joyful. But Jesus says, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. And then meekness, you know, that's not as common of a term these days, but I think it's very closely associated with humility, not exactly the same, but it is that idea of being very others-centered, and it's just not one of those attributes that we typically associate with being blessed. And even that whole concept of being blessed, according to Jesus, the way that the original hearers would understand that is, this is what the good life looks like according to God. This is what it means to be happy in God's eyes. And that's what blessed looks like. And so makarios is the word. People at that time, just like today, wanted to be happy. They wanted to be blessed. They wanted the good life. And Jesus very intentionally begins his sermon, very famous sermon, by kind of turning every one of our worldly assumptions on its head and says, it's not those who have all the wealth. It's not those who have all the fame. It's not those who have all the skills and who have, everything going their way all the time, externally at least. It's not those people that are the blessed ones. It's actually those who are lacking.
Yeah, it's true. And I think the thought that came to my mind, Jason, while you were talking about that, is the recognition of who we are in relationship to God. Like, some of the inherent blessing is to recognize who God is and who we're not and who we are in relationship to God. That's a big part of this, right? Because Jesus is talking to, the verse 1 says that he sat down to teach and his disciples came around him. But it said right before in the first line of verse 1, Jesus saw the crowds and he went up on a mountain. And after he sat down, his disciples came around him. So I don't think it's speaking of his direct disciples, just the 12. Right? It's the 12 plus the crowd, whoever's there. And so he's talking about, like, fundamentally, he's starting with our position in relationship to God and our need to recognize our need, essentially, right? That's what that poor in spirit is all about. Is not like, oh, woe is me, but it is the recognition of my need. Because if I don't begin with the recognition of my need, then the rest of it's not actually helpful to me. The rest of it's not actually useful to me. I think a good example of that is like what you see in Luke chapter 18, where we have this rich young ruler who comes to Jesus and he's like, hey, what do I have to do to be saved? And Jesus tells him to keep the law. And he's like, nailed it. What's next, right? And we're told that at the end of that exchange, the guy goes away sad because fundamentally or originally, he never recognized his need in the first place, right? Versus the next chapter, 19, where we're introduced to Zacchaeus, that crazy character that should not have gotten the grace of God by any means. And yet he does. He goes away rejoicing after meeting Jesus because he came to the table, recognizing his need. And it's like, I think of Romans chapter 3. There is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands. There's no one who seeks God, right? All have turned aside and gone and have done their own thing, right? Nobody's pursuing in and of themselves, in and of their flesh. Like, that's literally the position we're in apart from Christ and the recognition, okay, I have a desperate need. And until I understand that, then I don't actually get to experience the full blessing of what it is to be a part of this kingdom, right? To be a part of the followers of Jesus.
Yeah, And it gives so much hope to everybody because, you know, if your starting assumption is, well, I don't belong in Christianity or Christianity, you know, Jesus wouldn't want me, God wouldn't want me because I literally have done nothing religiously commendable in my life. And Jesus is saying, actually, that means the invitation is for you because you're recognizing you don't bring any merit. You don't bring any religious accomplishment, and you're not bringing any sense of self-righteousness. You're saying, I don't feel qualified. And Jesus is saying, you know, qualification isn't based on all these things that you have done or your moral record as the world sees it, especially, but even in God's eyes, we all fall short. There's nobody who would be able to say to God, our holy God, look at what I've done. Now, will you let me in? No, I mean, that's arrogance. That's the heart of pride that says God must accept me because, you know, assuming God would owe you, like that's arrogance. And yet it slips into our thinking so easily. Even after we're saved, after we come to Christ, we can, you know, slip into that performance mentality of, well, God will, surely be, more accepting of me based on the good life I'm living right now. And the reality is, yes, we're growing the longer we're walking with the Lord faithfully, but in no way do we ever have a claim on God. It's all by God's grace from first to last. And that's the beauty of the gospel. And it's also the humbling part of the gospel because it's not in our nature to want to say, okay, I'm just going to rely fully on grace. I'm just going to rely fully on the righteousness of Jesus. And yet that's what the spiritually poor person does is they're saying, I'm a, you know, basket case spiritually. I'm a mess. I'm spiritually bankrupt. And yet that is the very person who Jesus says is blessed. And the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these. You know, I think of later on in the Gospel of Matthew when Jesus is talking to people who are, you know, arguing about who's the greatest. And then he takes this little kid into his arms and he says, unless you become like this youngster right here, who's probably depending fully on his parents for food, sustenance, a, you know, roof over his head, all that stuff. You need to become like this little kid if you want to be in the kingdom. And you just imagine the shock rippling through the crowds who heard that. Like, what? He's not pointing to like that Pharisee over there with like the five stars of righteousness. You know, he's pointing to this kid who's literally contributed in no way to society or to even his household, probably other than maybe doing some chores. But in any case, he's using a kid as the example of what it looks like to have the heart of someone who will enter the kingdom. And I think that's the powerful takeaway of the Beatitudes is it's not in ourselves. And even that, the one that says, verse 6, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Well, the way I think about that is if you're hungering or thirsting for something, you're recognizing I need this, right? Like when you're today, I was out in the heat, you know, going for a run and getting some work done. And I was craving water. Like I was very thirsty at the end of that. And, in that there wasn't a sense of, oh, I'm totally satisfied as I am. No, I need something to drink. And I think that's what Jesus is getting at is those who recognize I am not satisfied with my own righteousness. I'm not satisfied with where I'm at spiritually. I need something that only Jesus can give. That's the righteousness we hunger and thirst for.
Yeah. And it really, all of these, you know, these first six verses, all of them relate back ultimately to seeing the glory of God, like seeing the righteousness of God, seeing the holiness of God, because that's the reason we become that, right? Is I come to see how God actually is. I come to see what holiness actually is. I come to see what righteousness actually is. That's that Isaiah 6 moment, right? I'm brought into the glory of God, and all I can do is fall on my face and be like, man, I'm a man of unclean lips, because I'm now face to face with the very glory of God, right? Face to face with the very righteousness of God. And that literally does change the equation. And so it's like, you know, this is not something that it's like, okay, I just got to be poor in spirit, whatever that means. I got to like pretend like that's a thing, or I got to, you know, blessed are those who mourn. So, oh, I got to be mournful all the time, right? And I got to be Debbie the Downer. And I got to force this kind of thing. It's like, no, by pursuing the Lord, these characteristics will just naturally result, because it's the byproduct. It's literally the byproduct of recognizing how awesome God is.
Yeah, it's a great point, Jamie, because, you know, ironically here, Jesus is laying out like those who are spiritual zeros are the blessed people, and how ironic it would be to like turn that into, oh, I've got to mourn enough, or I've got to be like feeling really bad about myself enough, and turning that into a works-based thing, because that's like the opposite of what Jesus is getting at. The point is that the ground at the foot of the cross is level. We all enter the kingdom the same way. It's all by grace, and to be in that sense of pride for how mournful you are, or you know, if you know, I was really fasting so much, like it was just feeling really, really hard, you know, that I was fasting so much, and you know, that made me kind of sorrowful, and it made me hunger and thirst for righteousness. No, I mean, if that's your mentality, then you're twisting what Jesus is saying, because the whole point of, if you were to fast, it would be, you know, Jesus is going to talk about this later, but you wouldn't want anyone to know, because then you're going to miss out on your reward in heaven. You only want to do it so that your Father knows. That's what he talks about. And then he also goes on to say that, and I think Dietrich Bonhoeffer touches on this in his book, The Cost of Discipleship, but the glory of the Beatitudes is not at all self-centered. It just pushes us to despair of anything in ourselves so that we can glory in who Jesus is, and just kind of bask in the wonder of, wow, look at how awesome he is. And you get a sense for this also because as he caps off the Beatitudes, he says, blessed are you when others revile you, persecute you, and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Now, if you're just reading the Sermon on the Mount for the first time, you might be wondering, like, well, why is he bringing himself into this? And you know, what, on my account, what's that about? Well, he's making the point that all of this ties back to him. And so if you are hungering and thirsting for righteousness, you're going to find it in him. If you are longing to be pure in heart and you want to see God, that's through Jesus, his sanctifying work in our life. The more we see Jesus as the goal and pursue Jesus, we're going to have purity in our life. We're going to be drawn away from all the sinful temptations as long as we're pursuing Jesus. And so in the same way, when it comes to persecution, if everything else has been tied back to him, then yeah, the persecution that you have because of following Jesus is something. So you're now suffering for his sake, and he says, you're blessed. You can rejoice. You can be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. And so if everything's about Jesus, then like, if I'm getting imprisoned, if I'm getting thrown in prison because of proclaiming the gospel and because I'm standing for Christ, then I can have joy because now I know that this is what it's like to suffer with Christ, and this is what it's like to be in his fellowship, and he's getting the glory, he's getting the honor, even as I'm being mistreated. And there's this unique kind of gift, this unique kind of reward that happens because, specifically because you're suffering on his behalf. And you notice this in the book of Acts when the first missionaries of the church, when they're suffering, they don't go into this sulky, like, oh, this isn't fair, I'm so mad, I mean, you just can't believe Jesus let this happen to me. No, they rejoice. Like, they're singing in prison, basically having a party, because, not because they're in prison so much, but because they're in prison for the sake of Jesus. And because they're able to experience his joy and his presence, even in the midst of their trials.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith Unpacked podcast. We're so thankful for your time. We hope and pray that these encourage your faith and walk with Jesus Christ. If you'd like to hear past episodes, you can find them on our website at faithunpacked.com. We'd also invite you to subscribe on your favorite podcasting site. If you have any questions, feel free to hit us up on social media, or you can send us an email at faithunpacked@gmail.com. And we invite you back next time as we continue to unpack our faith together.